that parable that you just heard is unquestionably one of the most familiar and beloved of all the parables that Jesus shares with his listeners and shares with the church even to this day. And it is that parable that I want to engage with you about over the coming moments. It comes to us, as you just heard, from the Gospel according to Luke, more or less in the middle of the Gospel. I think to frame it, it helps to remember Luke's narrative structure is pretty simple. The first section of Luke is about the birth of Jesus. Then you move into the second section of Luke. That is about the emergence of Jesus as the adult Messiah in Galilee and around the Sea of Galilee with his miracles, his teachings, his preachings, his healings, exorcisms, the mighty works of God that he does in Galilee. And then just prior to what you heard a moment ago, chapter 9, the end of chapter 9, before we get into 10, we're told that Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem. There's an abrupt shift from section 2 now into section 3 that is called the travel narrative. Jesus is going to leave Galilee, sets his face southward to go to Jerusalem. And of course, we know what's going to happen there. And so everything that follows in this section, the travel narrative, needs to be heard, needs to be read in the shadow of the cross. And that's true even for the parable of the Good Samaritan. Jesus has begun his journey, and he's got like three sorts of people who are around him. He's got his close followers, the 12, and then there's an outer band of disciples, the 72. He's got the curious followers. Who is this guy? What's going to happen next? And then he's got the watchful antagonists, a third group. They're just looking for any opportunity to trip him up, make him look bad, indeed, ultimately, to kill him. And it is somebody from that third group that intrudes upon the narrative today, and he is identified as a lawyer. Now, the attorneys in the room, don't get your back up just yet. Anyway. This is a religious leader, not like attorneys and lawyers we're used to today. The actual Greek translation doesn't identify him simply as a lawyer, but a certain lawyer, a certain type of lawyer. For those of us who are used to public speaking, there's often somebody in the room, Sunday school class, not usually a sermon, although occasionally, but there's a certain type, and they're just like waiting to challenge you. You said this, but what about that? Certain type. That's the kind of person we're dealing with here. And again, he's a lawyer. He's a religious scholar. And we're told also that he stood up. He stood up to challenge Jesus, which is a very aggressive, disrespectful posture when you're addressing a rabbi who would normally be seated. He stood up over him to test him, and he asks him this really inappropriate question. Teacher, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? It's actually not an inappropriate question. It's a really good question. It's a question that we all should be asking. Lord, what do I have to do to come into your kingdom, the ultimate reality that there is? Well, Jesus obviously sees right through this guy. It's a foundational question, but again, you can see that he's standing up to test it. And I'm paraphrasing the story here, but I just imagine Jesus sitting there looking up at him going, you're a religious scholar. You're a lawyer. You know the answer to your own question. What does it say in the scriptures? And he knows what it says in the scriptures. Any faithful Jew would have known. A summary of the entire book of laws of the Old Testament can be reduced to what we just said at the beginning of the service. What you heard in the gospel. Love God with all your might, with all your strength, with all your mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Quote from Deuteronomy and also from Leviticus. All of it collapsed down to that. Love God, love your neighbor. Says, you're right. Good job. But we're told that the lawyer now here wants to justify himself. You know, his plot has been foiled. Hadn't made Jesus look bad enough yet. He's like, okay, well, then who is my neighbor? And I think this is a technical question. It's, broadly speaking, a very good question that we were going to be asking this morning. Who is my neighbor? But it seems to me, in reading the text, reading the commentaries about this text, that what the lawyer is really asking is, how narrow a group of people can I define as my neighbor? Because I hope it's very narrow. I won't have to love as much. In other words, who is excluded from being my neighbor? And it's at this point that Jesus tells the familiar story. By the way, this is an anthropological point for us all. You know, the human brain is hardwired to hear things in threes. Somebody stands up to make a talk. I got three things I want to say. You're going to get people's attention. If you say, I've got eight things I want to say, you've lost them already. Three, we hear things in threes. A priest, a rabbi, and a Baptist walked into a bar. Oh, goodness, it's going to be a funny joke. Listen to this. So a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan are walking down the road. What's the story? This road that leads from Jerusalem down to Jericho, some of you have traveled it. You've been to the Holy Land. At the time of Jesus, was a well-traveled road, kind of like an interstate, if you would, for our day. But it was also notoriously dangerous if you were by yourself. It was a road where you might encounter brigands, robbers, thieves, gangs. There was danger. And we're told that a nameless person is walking from Jerusalem down to Jericho, where he indeed encounters one of these bad people or bad groups. Robbers beat him, rob him, leave him in the ditch on the side of the road. He's left for dead. Jesus says three people walk by. First, a priest. Second, a Levite. These two represent the very best of traditional Jewish religious life. And what do? They not only refuse to tend to the man in the ditch, they actually increase their distance from him by walking on the other side of the road. I don't really want to deal with this. I think I'm gonna step aside and just keep on my way. Mind my own business. But the Samaritan comes along, the third one, and I think from previous sermons and Sunday school lessons and Bible studies, you know this. The Samaritans were regarded as really outcasts, really disliked, perhaps even more than outright pagans by faithful Orthodox Jews of Jesus' day. Why? Long history here, but way back in the 8th century B.C., the land of the Samaritans, the 10 tribes of Israel, they were conquered by the Assyrian Empire, and they were assimilated, dispersed within that pagan empire. And over the course of the centuries, they just developed a lot of eccentric beliefs, add-ons to the Jewish faith. They had beliefs that didn't conform to traditional Jewish life. And so, as it often happens in families, the cousins or the half-brother is disliked even more than the total stranger. So the Samaritans were the object of particular scorn by people like a priest and a Levite. But it's this very one, the one you would least expect, who sees the man in the ditch, goes to him, binds up his wounds, puts him on his own animal as he's making this journey down from Jerusalem, takes him to an inn where he can recuperate. He promises to pay for whatever additional charges there are from the innkeeper taking care of this man. He says, I'm going to come back. I will return. Jesus tells this story to that certain type of lawyer. It says, who was the neighbor? And he says, got me. Obviously, it was a Samaritan. And indeed, that is the correct answer. So, I imagine in pulpits all over the place that are hearing this gospel story today and having people like me preach about it, this is the point where you hear the moral of the story. Be like the Samaritan, don't be like the Levite and the priest, right? Come on, y'all, do a better job of caring and loving people who are in the ditch, different from you, the poor, the outcast, people who look different from you, who come from different parts of the country, people who come from different countries entirely. We got to do better. And that is a message that I know I need to hear. Is that the moral of the story? Well, it is a moralism to draw from the story, but you know what? It's not the gospel. So my question is, what is the gospel in this story? We can hear that encouragement in any number of different contexts. You don't need to be in church to hear that. But where is the good news in this story? I know that I do know this. We all feel sort of disquietude about the furies of our day, this age. Lots of polling shows us this goes back actually more than a decade, where Americans have increasingly worried that we're on the wrong road, we're going the wrong direction. And interestingly, that's exactly what the characters in the story do. Jesus is going to Jerusalem, and everybody in the parable is going away from Jerusalem. Maybe it feels like we're going away from Jerusalem. Actually, the increasingly, there's a loss of neighborliness, mutual respect and understanding and indeed compassion, which is at the heart of the story. People who wear red caps or wear blue hair, they don't feel like they're neighbors, right? But the events of life, the chances and changes that occur to us in the course of daily living can snap us out of that, and even tragedies. Remind us of what neighborliness will get for your children. A week ago today, I had cut my vacation short to return to Houston, Texas, where I'm the rector of a large church there, where there were many, many, many people in that congregation, not to mention throughout Houston and all over Central Texas and beyond, who were affected by those terrible floods. We just had an 8-year-old girl in our parish whose body was found just yesterday. And I went back. We had a little prayer service between two big services, and the chapel, not a room unlike this, not like this, was filled with people, and so heavy. Like, you're sniffling and crying, a lot of stillness. And then that Monday night, this past week, we had a community prayer service at our church. I stood in front of the congregation as I'm standing in front of you now. It's 1,200 people. One of the things that most impressed me about that moment was not just the sound of sniffling and crying, but how still it was. People were just utterly still, because that's what life brings us to. Just like the man in the ditch, left for half dead, at least emotionally in that case, spiritually in many cases. Of course, literally. Left for dead. The atmosphere in the room was, in a moment like this, if there's anything that is going to bring us back to life, it's going to have to come from beyond ourselves. We cannot do it. I don't know what to say. I don't have explanations. I don't have a magic wand to make grief go away. Neither do you. We can come together as neighbors and strangers. Act neighborly toward one another, and acknowledge that we're in a place in our lives where we're like the man in the ditch, left for dead. Somebody's going to have to come and help us. Somebody's going to have to cross the road, bind up our wounds, take us with himself where he's going. He promises to return to us as well. I think we're hearing all of that as a pattern of Jesus' own life. Heed the story, the word that brings the whole parable to the foot of the cross is the word compassion. We're told that the Samaritan is the one who had compassion. We hear that word and we know what it means. We think we do. It means to suffer with somebody. But the biblical word really is even stronger than that. It literally has to do with your guts. Something that is utterly gut-wrenching. We know that in Texas right now. You've known it here in North Carolina last year. And you know it in your personal life. Certain chapters or episodes that maybe you can like this morning. What it is to feel like, I think my guts here are just torn. That's what Jesus discloses to us. The central thing that Jesus discloses to us about the heart of God is God's compassion. Just like the Samaritan sees the helpless man on the side of the road, God looks at us and sees us as helpless on the side of the road and comes to us. He who knew no sin became sin. By his wounds we are healed. Our wounds are healed. And again, Jesus is not going away from Jerusalem. He's intersecting all of us who walk away from Jerusalem by nature. Through our patterns, through our sin, through our brokenness, and through the tragedies of life, it calls us to ask out, Lord, where are you? I have no power within myself to get myself out of the ditch. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It'll happen because of me. The good news is that as Jesus completes his walk to Jerusalem, going from below up there, as these men are going down, as we all are going the wrong direction, he shows us the compassion. In his cross, there is the power to bind up all your brokenness, your woundedness, forgive your sins, most of all, give the assurance. Whatever it is that you may go through in life that brings you to a place where you're just still and you can't move, that is not ultimate. It's real, and it's painful, and it's hard, but it's not the final word. We allow that truth truly to penetrate our hearts. Allow Jesus to bind up our wounds. Not only are we in contact with the gospel itself will change us.